Episode 252, Russell Jack, retired U.S. Senior Air Marshal.
It wasn't really a mistake in that I stopped him because of his description, but it was a mistake because he wasn't the right person. But here's what I learned from that.
I'm Mark Graben. This is My Favorite Mistake. In this podcast, you'll hear business leaders and other really interesting people talking about their favorite mistakes. Because we all make mistakes, but what matters is learning from our mistakes instead of repeating them over and over again. So this is the place for honest reflection and conversation, personal growth, and professional success. Visit our website at myfavoritemistakepodcast.com.
To learn more about Russell and his book, look for links in the show notes or go to markgraben.com/mistake252. As always, thanks for listening. And now, on with the show.
Hi, welcome to the podcast. I'm Mark Graben. My guest today is Russell K. Jack. He's a retired U.S. Senior Federal Air Marshal. He worked in that role from 2002 to 2022. Russell previously served 5 years as a federal police officer. And before that, he served 5 years in the Colorado Army National Guard and was deployed in Saudi Arabia as part of Desert Storm. So those are a few things about Russell's background and credentials. He is also now a first-time author. We're going to be talking about his book. It's titled, Is MAGA a Terrorist Movement? And it is available now. I might have made a mistake. Is MAGA a Terrorist Movement? Better way to pronounce that, Russell?
I've heard it said both ways. I always say MAGA, but I've heard it pronounced MAGA too.
Yeah. So that is the least important mistake of anything that we're going to talk about. So before we talk about the book, Russell, as we always do, you know, I'm curious to hear your story. What would you say is your favorite mistake?
My favorite mistake actually happened a long time ago. I was actually a security officer at a major hospital. And a lot of crime and a lot of problems there. And a man had stolen a purse from a lady who worked there right in front of her, grabbed it right off the counter and ran out. And so we got a call out for it and got a description of the man. So I took detailed notes. And as we were looking for the suspect, I found him. And so I stopped him and detained him. And it's very common, even when you detain someone who is guilty, who really was a person doing it, for them to say, oh, no, that's not me. So he was saying that while I was detaining him. And a call came over the radio and they said, hey, we got the guy. And I called back and I said, are you sure? I've got a guy here who matches the description almost perfectly. And they said, yes, for sure, we have the guy. And I'm like, okay, great. So I went to the guy and I told him, I said, hey, we got the person that was wanted. It wasn't you. But you know, the mistake that happened where I stopped him wasn't really a mistake in that I stopped him because of his description, but it was a mistake because he wasn't the right person. But here's what I learned from that is he had a look on his face that he was black, I'm white, and he was like, yeah, you stopped the black guy. And I'm like, do you mind if I show you the description? And so he said, yeah, no problem. So I showed it to him. I showed him my notes. And as he read it, he goes, wow. He goes, yeah, that's me. That's why you stopped me. And I said, yeah. I said, I just wanted you to know, you know, I didn't just stop you because I was looking for a black male. You know, you matched height, you matched weight, you matched clothing description. You matched pretty much perfectly. And the conversation was much better after that. And I think that mistake helped me learn that, you know, when time allows for it, it's huge to, as a uniformed officer, whether it's security, police, an agent, if you stop someone in an official capacity, it's important for them to understand why. You know, if I had just said, okay, you're free to go and left, you know, that guy probably would have gone home and gone, yeah, once again, you know, I'm being racially profiled. So it was really good that I got that opportunity early on to realize how important it is, if time allows, to explain why you're doing something to people.
Wow. Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I mean, it's an interesting story because when you told him, if these weren't the exact words, you're free to go.
Yeah.
He could have just walked away and ended that conversation with you, as was Absolutely. His right. Right. But.
And that's why I offered, you know, I said, hey, would you like to look at my description that I had for the person I was looking for? And he said, yeah, sure. And when he looked at it, I could see just a complete change in his demeanor. He's like, oh my God. Yeah. I totally understand why you stopped me. You know, he said something to that effect. So it was a much better citizen contact after that.
Was there a similar situation then that you ran across in the future, or at least a situation where somebody might have thought they were being racially profiled, where Was there that extra step to try to help them understand that then?
Yeah, many times. In one particular situation I have that happened, I won't go into the details of it, but we had felt that there was enough of a need to stop and make contact while undercover. And one of the people I made contact with just by mistake had happened to bump me in a way where, you know, it was pretty obvious that I was armed. And I thought he'd done it deliberately. And it just turns out he just did a little, you know, a little twitch and hit it with his elbow, but he didn't react. So when he didn't react, I was like, oh boy, I got a problem. So he got lumped into the people we were concerned about. But after making contact, official contact, and I explained to him what happened and why he was stopped, he said, oh, okay, that actually makes sense. And, you know, we did have some other people that were involved that were a problem, but he wasn't one of them. But he got lumped into it because of his actions, even though he didn't mean to do anything. But once I explained to him what happened and everything else that was going on, he was like, okay, that makes sense. You know, so when we can explain, we won't always have time, but when we can explain as law enforcement or any official position, honestly, why we did something, and the person, you know, if the person's, you know, receptive to that, it's good to explain it.
Yeah. And was that something then that was a topic of conversation with fellow officers about situations like that and what you learned? Was that something that you felt free to share with others?
Free to share, yes. But I've noticed that topic really doesn't come up as much as it should. It wasn't really an official part of our training. Hey, if you get the chance, make sure you do this. I think that's more something I learned from actually being an officer. It's important when I was leading my platoon, in order to have people who are following you, you have to earn the respect to be a leader. It can't be given to you. You can be a supervisor. You can be a manager. You can be in charge. But to actually be a leader that people want to follow, they have to know that you have their back, that the mission and their safety and welfare comes before your own safety and comfort. You put them first. So I think it is important to explain to people when you can what's going on. Like in the military, you know, sometimes an order had to just be carried out. It's like, hey, here's your order, go do it. But when time allows and you can explain what that is, it's better on two levels. One, it lets a person know, hey, here's what's going on. It gives them some background and some more details, so they have a better understanding of what they're doing. And then also too, you know, it helps them know, hey, it's not just, hey, go do this and, you know, I'm done with you. It's, hey, I really appreciate you doing this. Just like with the person that we stopped saying, hey, I have enough time. The reason I stopped you was this. Mm-hmm. So that way later they don't think, hey, I was just being picked on or profiled. Yeah.
And I think there's an important general lesson that applies in business. Like what you learned about the power and the importance of explaining why. I've seen that apply in one auto factory short story. I started my career at General Motors, and there were all kinds of just directive orders given. So like there might be a box of parts, and there would be a sign that said literally, you know, do not use, and it would be signed by someone's name. It was completely authority based, you know, because I said so, don't use these parts. I had a chance to visit a plant in California that was jointly run by Toyota and General Motors, similar situation. And there was a sign that said, again, pretty literally, do not use these parts. Using them in a vehicle could lead to brake failure and injury to customer. Like, that was such a powerful lesson in a totally different circumstance of taking 10 seconds to explain why. Like that's treating people like adults and helping them make, in that case, the good choice.
That's a great idea. Great idea. And when time allows it, it doesn't harm anything. You know, I've had situations where I've had to tell, you know, like my troops, I was like, yeah, this sucks, but we got to do it. It's an order, you know, and they respect that more than if you just tell them, hey, everything's great. You know, they can see through that. People are intelligent. You know, they will figure that out. And it's better if you try to give them as much information as you are allowed to.
Yeah. And then Russell, maybe one last question about your story before we move forward and talk about the book. You know, in that very particular story, like you said, that was not a case of racial profiling. It was based on that very specific description. It would probably be a mistake for someone to listen and take away from your story. Well, see, racial profiling doesn't happen. Because, I mean, how would you answer to that question of how frequently does that happen?
I think it does happen often. I mean, there's always some bad apples out there who, you know, do have a grudge. But a lot of times it can happen subconsciously. And that is what you have to always be vigilant for. And I learned early on in my career to look for criminal behaviors, you know, criminal and terroristic behaviors. the majority of people are good, you know, honest people that aren't looking for trouble. They just want to raise their family, live in peace, and live their life. It's a very small number of people of any group who are bad. And, you know, they're the extremists. They're the ones who are willing to engage in illegal or terroristic activity to force their will on others. And generally, that's a big thing I'm fighting for is in America, you're free to do what you want. As long as it's not illegal and you're not harming anyone else, do what you want. But that's where we get into this problem is in any group, whether it be religious or culture, or if they're trying to enforce their ideas on how to behave on someone else, especially in an illegal way, that's where there's a problem. Hope that answered the question. Okay.
It did. Yeah. And I think that gives us a segue to the book and the MAGA movement, the Make America Great Again, quote unquote, movement and elements of that movement trying to force their ways onto others as you document and write about in the book. So the title of the book, again, we're joined by the author, Russell K. Jack. Is MAGA a terrorist movement? I guess it's not really a spoiler alert. Your answer, your one word answer in the book is yes.
Yeah, exactly. I decided it'd be better than just one word. I'd go ahead and write a whole book instead of just saying yes, opening up yes.
So I mean, I'm going to ask you to define some terms because I think it's important context. I mean, you've mentioned this that you worked in anti-terrorism. How do you define terrorism more broadly, and how does that apply to the MAGA movement and Donald Trump, even personally?
Okay. Well, there's two different ways to kind of two different definitions of terrorism. One is just the method of using intimidation and harm as a method of warfare, you know, to force your will on someone else. When you look at the actual definition of terrorism, it's using intimidation, coercion, and force, especially against a civilian population and against the government, in order to illegally enforce your will, your political will. So that's terrorism. And one of the things that I do that helps me, even when I'm talking with somebody who is MAGA, is to explain, hey, look, this isn't, I hate Republicans, okay? I generally lean a little more left, but I'm not in one political group. The problem is whenever you have a group of people who are willing to engage in illegal activity, okay, we saw this on January 6th. That was a riot and it was an insurrection. And it did violate the 12th Amendment. They did stop the votes from being counted, which is the 12th Amendment. So it was an unconstitutional and illegal act. And the illegality of it, I don't think anybody who watched what happened on January 6th would argue there was just random chance that it happened to be the day and time that they were ratifying the vote. The intent was clearly to stop the government from ratifying that vote. And if you look up what an insurrection is, that's what it is. It's an attempt to overthrow or to stop a government from its functioning. And that is clearly the intent on January 6th was to stop that ratification of the vote. So they were using harm, intimidation, and fear to enforce their political will. So that's terrorism.
And part of the question is, you know, did Donald Trump direct that activity, or was it closer? I've heard a phrase, stochastic terrorism.
Not familiar with that one. I'm sorry.
Well, so I think and I've heard that term used, that stochastic terrorism is, it's sort of like a mob boss who's not directly doing the things, but is sort of saying things that would cause others, like there's that plausible deniability of like, oh, I didn't mean literally to go storm the Capitol and stop the vote.
Gotcha. Yeah. In my book, that's one of the things I cover is I talk about that. I say, you know, there's, in America, you need to be convicted before you're sent to jail. And that's a good thing. That's what we want. I don't want to be sent to jail. You don't want to be sent to jail just because somebody says, yeah, I think you did it. You should go to jail. But Al Capone, okay, this is one of the examples I give in there versus Wesley Snipes. Okay, Al Capone and Wesley Snipes were tax evaders. Now, in no world does anyone think Al Capone was not a gangster, but he wasn't convicted as one. He wasn't. So you can't look at the conviction and say, hey, he wasn't convicted, therefore he didn't do it. Okay, well, if you look at the litany of criminal charges, 91 criminal charges against Donald Trump in four different jurisdictions, or in four different cases, I should say, it goes against conscience to believe that this is probably someone who has not committed a crime. Now, obviously, As always, you know, America, we always have to say this, you know, guilty until proven innocent. Yes, alleged until you're convicted. But that being said, anyone watching the activities, what happened on January 6th, the reason we passed RICO, the Racketeering Influenced Corrupt Organization Act, was because of people like Al Capone. Because under that act, there's, I think it was, I can't remember if it was 30 or 35 different crimes that their henchmen carry out. But as long as we can prove that the person or persons in charge are part of that enterprise, even if they don't get their hands dirty, they're still culpable. I talked with a family member who said, hey, wait a minute, you know, just because he wasn't a big believer in like conspiracy. He wasn't like, hey, if you're not the one doing it, you shouldn't get in trouble. But here's the problem is if a person in position of power is telling their subordinates or underlings or even just implying to, in this case, MAGA, go commit an illegal activity, they are culpable. That is a crime. Okay, once RICO came out, now it is a criminal act to tell your underlings to go do a criminal activity if that nexus can be proven. That's what's going on in Georgia with the RICO crimes there. But again, under our system, until proven guilty, criminally, he's not guilty. But I think anybody watching January 6th, there's no way a reasonable person could believe that that wasn't the intent. It happened on the day they're ratifying the vote. They stormed the Capitol. They were saying, hang Mike Pence because he didn't throw the vote. I mean, it's very clear there isn't any reasonable way to say that that was not what happened.
Right. And one example of terrorism would be death threats that maybe are, you know, Donald Trump badmouths somebody and says, you know, we should be rid of them or something that's kind of vague. And then death threats follow from the MAGA movement. Like that's not directly, but it's not hard to connect. Well, that happened because of Trump demonizing somebody, right?
Correct. And one thing I learned in my career, there's many instances of things that terrorists and terrorist supporters do that they haven't yet been charged with or may never get charged with. It doesn't mean they're not doing things that are related to or are terrorism. So in this case, if he has millions of followers, which he does, he has a cult of personality. When he tweets something, his followers are listening and they act on it. And the problem is, and this is the problem I've had in discussion with another man that I met that was, you know, he was much more pro-right. He wasn't really MAGA, but he was very, very conservative. And he said, well, I think you're being unfair picking on them. And I said, well, wait a minute. The problem is, I don't think Joe Biden has a cult of personality where millions of followers are waiting on his next tweet to commit illegal activities. Okay. The problem is when you have a powerful person who is pushing for illegal actions to occur and terroristic actions to occur, especially if they're trying to change government by doing it, this is now much more of a threat. And it would be a threat even if it was Democrats doing it. It's not. There isn't a comparable group that I found. And that's one of the things in this discussion with this man, I said, is I'm not finding a parallel. You know, if there is a group like MAGA out there in America, I want to know about it, but it would be pretty obvious at this point if there was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the right and Fox News, their equivalent or their boogeyman is Antifa.
Right.
But that's, I think as you say in the book, that's not a direct parallel. That's certainly not part of a quote unquote cult of Biden.
Yeah. And one of the things I find interesting is I actually had that discussion back when I was working, and after it happened, you hear some outrageous things from the right. And one thing that's always bothered me is that, to me, it seems like if you really listen, shouldn't you see the contradiction? And I explained that. I said, wait a minute. So you're saying it was a false flag operation. Antifa got you into trouble. Well, hold on. Antifa stands for anti-fascism, literally 100% against what you're trying to do. And even though they're not, you know, I think the term I used in my book was they're not, everything they do isn't sunshine and rainbows, but I guarantee you they did not want Donald Trump to remain as president. So it makes no sense. And also too, they can't have it both ways. You know, when he's saying, hey, these are hostages, these are patriots, these are heroes. Well, wait a minute. I thought they were victims of a false flag operation. Are they victims or are they patriots that deliberately went against the 12th Amendment? And the answer is the latter.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's a lot that doesn't make sense. And there's sort of this rubber glue, you know, if not projection, I think, as you described in the book of the word fascist. And then, you know, it gets thrown back at, oh, well, you know, Joe Biden and his followers are fascists. I mean, it doesn't seem to meet the definition. It's just a word that's being thrown around. But not to try to make you a walking dictionary here, but what's an important, Well, the definition, and maybe more importantly, the definition of fascist and what that means for the MAGA movement and if they win in 2024.
Okay. Well, I mean, the simplest way to explain fascism, to paraphrase it, is simply one party rule with a dictator at top. Now, it doesn't have to be a dictator. It can just be a strong president. Okay. But once you have the president, the leader in charge, and you have control of the rest of the government, two-thirds majority in Congress, and in a sympathetic or aiding judicial branch with the Supreme Court, once you have all those pieces in place, it very quickly, as we discussed, I think at one point, that if you have that system, you don't need a single vote from an actual American. We have a representative democracy, not a true democracy. So once we elect those people in, we hope they do what we want, but they don't have to do what we want. So the problem is once they have that kind of control, now they can start doing whatever they want. So a fascism, to define it, is generally one leader, usually has a cult of personality, usually has a lot of people following them, and then they get into the government and control, and then that government then becomes very against anyone who's going to try to talk bad about it or work against mm-hmm. it. So right. That's one of the reasons they attack the First Amendment like they do, mm-hmm. is yeah. because they don't want people learning the real facts, because if they did, they would realize, hey, the things we're doing are illegal. They are unconstitutional. They are terroristic. Mm-hmm. And that's not being a good American.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to ask about the 14th Amendment and, you know, the clause that says basically, if you participate, I'm paraphrasing, if you participated in insurrection, which doesn't say convicted of,
correct.
Back to your point about the legal standard, participated in insurrection, you are by definition not allowed to be, or you're ineligible for office unless Congress votes two thirds to remove that restriction. It's not two thirds a vote to get you off the ballot, for example. So there's a lot of legal battles here, but is a mistake that we don't have a clear legal definition of what it means insurrection? Because I've heard people say, like, oh, it wasn't an insurrection, it was a riot. Or they'll say they were just tourists and whatever. But I mean, is there that gray area of, I mean, it looked like a insurrection.
Well, if I'm ever a tourist, I don't want it to be like that. Because that did not look peaceful to me.
No.
So one of the problems is, my opinion, the forefathers, the reason why they did a lot of things they did is you have the concept of originality, or, you know, the original constitutionalism you hear a lot from like conservative judges. And the problem is, if you go back and look at what the forefathers thought, it's even more strongly worded that they made it clear they don't want you holding any office. And office, for people who don't know, is a position. I held the office of a federal air marshal. Okay. Any office is a job, is a position in the state or federal government. And it makes it very clear in the 14th Amendment, Section 3, that if you engaged in, aided and abetted, gave aid and comfort to rebellion or insurrection in any way, you are not eligible to hold any position in the state or federal governments, any of the states, any federal government position. So I'm pretty sure, going off the originality concepts, the forefathers didn't say, well, wait, except president. The president can be an insurrectionist. That's okay.
Well, so there's been this argument that the president is, quote, not an officer of the United States. It just doesn't pass the smell test.
Correct. It's the office of the presidency. So, yes, right. It is.
Yeah. But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. And I agree with you. The 14th Amendment, Section 3, one of the problems we have is the reason they didn't go into all this detail is because they thought they made it really clear. You know, if you engaged in it, it says engaged. It doesn't say convicted. It doesn't say after being formally charged in a court of law and convicted. It says if you engaged in that activity. And most people would say, well, that's wishy-washy. No, it's not. If I applied for my old job and went to get my top secret clearance, I assure you, if I had engaged in rebellion or insurrection, I wouldn't have gotten that job or that clearance.
And that amendment was passed after the Civil War. So there was a pretty clear right. standard, I imagine, of having served in the Confederate military or having an elected position within the Confederate States. That was all pretty cut and dry, right? If there was evidence, you participated.
Yeah, and that's another argument I'd heard too is, well, this was a Civil War era one. It was designed to punish people who worked in the Civil War. Yeah, that was part of it, I'm sure. But the other part of it is if they wanted it to just be the Civil War, they would have said anyone who was involved in the Civil War can't do this. They didn't. They said anybody who does rebellion or insurrection or aids and abets or gives aid and comfort to same and engages in that activity cannot work for the federal or state government in any capacity. So when one of the judges in Colorado, when she said, yeah, there's scant direct evidence that the presidency is one of those positions covered, I was just like shaking my head. I'm like, it's not scant. It's very direct. It says no position, no office, no employment of any kind for the federal government or state government if you engaged in rebellion or insurrection or helped anyone who did. So I think it's pretty cut and dry. I think any arguments over the interpretation of it probably aren't valid.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask, you know, about the expected audience for the book as you wrote it, and it's available now. Is the audience for the book the people who would already answer yes to that question? Some sort of convincible middle? And if so, how much of a convincible middle do you think there is?
Well, my hope with this book is twofold. One is I want to get the awareness out there. There's a lot of people I've run into who don't have a full understanding of everything that's going on. They're like, yeah, I realize MAGA's problem. I realize they're doing bad things, but they're not aware of how large the problem is, you know, how invasive it is, that it's in our federal government, it's in our state government, it's in the military. And there's some confusion over how dangerous it actually is. So for reaching out to them, I think it gives them, the people who are interested in learning more about it and really have a better full understanding of who they are, what they're trying to accomplish, and the methods they're using, I think that's where that book's going to really gain ground. And yes, obviously the majority of people are going to be non-MAGA. Now, my hope is that some MAGA, even if they're trolling, you know, even if they're just looking for, hey, Russ made a mistake, I want them to look, and I don't want to turn those people off. You know, a lot of people I work with for over two decades are good people. Even the ones that were later indoctrinated in the MAGA movement, they think they're doing the right thing. And I really hope that they take an objective step back and take a look and see, hey, your actions don't meet what is patriotic, what is legal, and what is constitutional. So I am hopeful that it will convert at least a few. But honestly, yes, 99%+ is going to be non-MAGA, unfortunately. I haven't, to my knowledge, convinced anybody yet firsthand to give up on MAGA, you know, no matter what I say. But I do hope that there are people who are going to objectively listen to this, even if they don't like me, even if they're MAGA, mm-hmm. and say, wait a minute, you know, is what I'm doing illegal? Is what I'm doing terroristic? You know, is what I'm doing unconstitutional?
Yeah. So I was going to ask you that. You've already answered the question. You know, have you convinced anybody? Have you run across people in your travels, even if you hadn't convinced them, where at some point they had convinced themselves? Like they might now say it was a mistake to have previously supported or voted for him. I mean, other than most of his former cabinet members and his former vice president, there's got to be others.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I haven't had any luck with that. Yeah. One of the things I also covered in that book was that when people are convinced of an idea and you show them direct evidence that shows they're wrong, their more common reaction than not is not to say, hey, that's, you know, I'm going to take a step back and think about that.
Yeah. Thanks for
it's to get angry.
Yeah. Right.
They lash out at the person saying it. They don't stop and think. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. I mean, that's part of what makes this really difficult. I mean, like I remember like one person comes to mind, Chris Christie, said, you know, this was during the primary here in, you know, back in 2023 when he was running for the Republican nomination, said in pretty plain and clear language, Chris Christie used the word mistake, that he realized now it was a mistake. I don't think he was saying that just because he was now running against him any more than Mike Pence decided to not endorse Trump because he had been running against him and also lost. Like there, you know, people who have worked with him very closely seem more willing to say, hey, it was a mistake to get into bed with this guy than the broader movement would be to realize that or say that. And like, are they working off of some idealized version of what they think he is compared to people who actually saw firsthand, you know?
This is the disturbing part is I have been talking obviously with a lot of people, and this one's hearsay because it was a friend of someone I know, and they are Republican and they actually work helping with the judges and things like that. And they're very upset over MAGA. A lot of people who are what I call true Republicans. Okay. If you look at the Republican charter, MAGA's violating it horribly. So anyone who is Republican is very upset at this point that MAGA has taken over their party completely. At this point, now that the nomination is going to be Donald Trump is MAGA, MAGA is Donald Trump. So therefore, the Republican Party is now the MAGA Party. And that's got to be frustrating. I mean, the first country that was taken over by the Nazis was Germany. Okay. The first thing that's being taken over by MAGA is the Republican Party. So I can understand why someone who's a true Republican should be very upset over the fact that their party has been destroyed by this movement.
And you, in the book, you use the word pseudo a lot. So you could say pseudo Republican Party. A minute ago, you used the word patriotic. And in the book, you kind of break down the difference between patriotism and pseudo patriotism. Could you maybe share an example of what that means?
One of the reasons I chose to use that particular word is because that's a false sham version of something where you're pretending to be something that you really aren't. The German Bund movement that back in, I think it was 1939, it's in my book, that where they had 20,000 people at Madison Square Garden and they were doing a Nazi salute as an oversized American flag went by. So this isn't the first time that our patriotic symbols have been usurped. And that's what's happening now is they're saying, hey, if you're a true patriot, then you're MAGA. Okay, well, no, true patriotism is not that. So I use the word pseudo to say, hey, you know what? Over a billion Christians and Muslims don't believe in this. Okay. Just like 9/11. And when you look at groups like Al Qaeda or ISIS, okay, the vast majority of religious people are good, moral people, and they don't use terrorism and bigotry and hate and inflict their will on others against those people's wills. They'll try to convert them. Absolutely. I totally understand that. And they can vote that way. If they're like, hey, if you want to have a right wing vote for it, that's awesome. But when you start doing illegal and terroristic things, you know, that's where you have a problem. That's why I use the word pseudo, because I don't want people who are part of, say, Islam to be associated directly with ISIS just because they're Muslim. The vast majority of Muslims don't believe that, just like the vast majority of Christians don't believe in a hardcore extremist right version of Christianity where they enforce their will on others. So pseudo, I thought, was the best way to make sure people understand that. And sorry to talk a little bit longer, but one little thing I learned, there's a lot of Islamophobia that went on when I first became an agent after 9/11. And I came on in 2002. And a lot of those people were getting attacked because they looked Muslim. And I may add, they also attacked sheiks who aren't Muslim, but they just thought they were, so they attacked them anyway.
Those weren't
the people who did the attack. They weren't the ones who supported the attack. And one thing that dawned on me after a while, a lot of coworkers I had were very, you know, bigoted in that way. I hate to say that. I shouldn't say a lot, many, some. Mm-hmm. I realized something. I'm like, wait a minute. If over a billion Muslims really felt that way, we would know. Yeah. So no, it's a very small number of any religion or group of people that are willing to use illegal force on others to inflict their will. And those are the extremists. They're a small mm-hmm. number of people.
Mm-hmm. And so then when you talk about a government or a party that becomes a government inflicting its will on people. And in the book, you use the word authoritarian. And I'm going to quote you from the book here. You're saying, our democracy, I think this is a direct quote, that our democracy will start to end the day he takes office again. I mean, what would you expect to start happening in the years 2025 and beyond?
Well, here's the reason why I say that. And in the book, I said it too as well, especially now. And I used a cutesy little quote, you know, Teflon Don, but it is true. I mean, if he can beat 91 charges over four different cases and secure the presidency, he already was working to, you know, get rid of the checks and balances in the government and have one party rule, the Republicans, which is now MAGA. So if he's able to beat everything that's happening to him right now, I mean, owing $500 million about, you know, from a successful lawsuits against him, having 91 felonies, if he can manage to beat all that and become president, it's not going to take, I mean, anybody who can pull that off, it's not going to take long before they, especially when they have people in position of power supporting them. He would have been impeached had the Republican Party stepped up to make that happen. That was when the Republican Party died, in my opinion, is when they, only 10 of them, I think it was, actually voted to impeach. And it was something like 57 and they needed 67. If 10 more Republicans had done the right thing, and many of them knew that that was the right thing, They turned their back on their duty, in my opinion. If they had done that, he would have been impeached and he would be ineligible to run and this nightmare would have ended. They didn't. And in fact, they've done the opposite. They're like, hey, I like power. So if this guy gets in charge, I'm going to have a lot of power. And that's what scares me, you know, is the politics of it. If he gets in after everything that's going on with him, if he manages to secure the presidency, then if he can beat all that, it won't take long. Things will start falling within the year of his first year. And I would imagine by the end of his four-year term, his second term, before he starts his third, because he will, they'll get rid of the 22nd Amendment. No reason to have a two-term limit anymore. So these are the kind of things that happen to fascist government. I mean, look at Putin. I mean, how many times has he been reelected? And he just got reelected again.
We're going to say pseudo-election.
Yeah, he got reelected like 87%. Okay, it's false. It's a dictatorship. So that's my concern is them getting in power like that. And to people who are listening who are MAGA, if you flip the script and this was Democrats doing this, I would still be on the show and I would still be talking badly about them instead.
And I would have had you on the podcast.
That may be. But yeah, that's the problem. The problem is fascism. And the word gets thrown around a lot. But if you just think of it as one powerful person at top, one party rule, and then they forcibly stop everybody else from competing with them, that's in a nutshell fascism. And it doesn't matter which party, which group. Once it happens, then you start losing your rights.
I mean, I value and appreciate my freedom. I appreciate my ability to vote. And I mean, you know, not to be overly dramatic about it, like I'd probably end up on some sort of list from even having you on the podcast. You're on the list before.
Oh yeah.
of what that means or what that means for our ability to speak out. Podcasters, unless officially approved, will be the latest enemy of the people.
Correct.
If we're even still able to do these podcasts. And, you know, I don't know if it's a mistake to think, there's some we say, well, look, the first time around, the system of checks and balances and some other, you know, factors kept him in line. But, you know, I hate to say, I'm going to turn this into a question. You know, on the podcast here, we talk about the importance of learning from mistakes. Does MAGA think they made mistakes in late 2020, early 2021, or even mistakes made in the beginning of his first term? Gosh, they've learned not to repeat those mistakes. It's going to lead to a worse outcome if they're learning from why they weren't able to, you know, sort of remain in power that first time.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're asking. There's a lot of control already happening and they have learned from these lessons. I'm not going to say as an overall group that they're going to always do everything right. I mean, nobody does, but they have gotten more power and they've started to test how to change these checks and balances. I mean, a perfect example is when he got impeached. There isn't any reasonable human being who looked at that and didn't say, yeah, he needs to be impeached. Okay. So what happened is because of power and because of their MAGA base, politicians said, well, wait a minute, if I do the right thing, I'm not going to get reelected. But if I do the wrong thing, I'll be, you know, the hero of his followers and I'll get reelected over and over again. So what do? They do what's in their best interest instead of what they're supposed to do, which is their duty. So yeah, I have a huge problem with that. Shout out to the Republicans who lost their careers to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, earlier you talked about cult of personality. And I'm going to ask this carefully, or don't want to end up on another. I'm not going to commit a crime here. But if Trump were to die of natural causes tomorrow, what happens to the MAGA movement?
That's an interesting question. Cult of personality is huge. Without him in the picture, honestly, I think it'll fall apart. I mean, he's that much. You know, it's kind of like the Mussolini and the Hitlers and. And even the ones that are more peaceful, like Gandhi, they're pivotal in that movement. So I think with him gone, I think that if he died of natural causes, that the movement would fall apart. I don't think the movement would stop as far as, you know, lots of people believing in Make America Great Again. But the problem is, I don't think they would have that central figure, that cohesive thing to rally behind. I think they'd become more disorganized than they already are. And I think they'd become much less effectual. And I don't think they'd have a chance of winning and taking over the government. So I think without Donald Trump, the MAGA movement will not be as efficient and not have a very good chance of success.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see what happens this year. The impact of it is huge. And one other thing came to mind, you know, maybe before we wrap up here, you know, we think about the projection and the idea of the thing you're accusing your opponents of is the thing that you're doing. You know, the other day, you know, I think Trump said something like, well, if Biden gets reelected, that'll be the last election that's ever held. And I'm like, Biden has his faults, but the idea that he would dismantle our ability to vote seems like the furthest thing from being possible.
Absolutely.
Your thoughts on that.
One of the things I find funny about projection is when they say things, MAGA will say things towards non-MAGA people, you know, Democrats or anyone who doesn't, you know, agree with them. They'll say things like, oh, you're fascist, you know, and you're going to try to take away our guns and, you know, take away our rights. And I would stop them and I'd say, do you know what fascism is? And, or say, hey, do you know what this constitutional amendment is? And they would give you this blank look and they'd be like, oh, I don't know. I'd be like, there are only 27 amendments in there and like six articles. I mean, just read it. I mean, it'll take you a couple of hours to get at least an idea. I mean, I'm not a constitutional expert. You absolutely, if you said, hey, read every single one, I would flub it for sure. But the important ones, and all of them are important, but reading through it and kind of learning is important. And when they do that projection, it doesn't work because they say, well, you're a fascist. Well, wait a minute, what's a fascist? Okay, I don't want one party rule. I don't want a dictator in charge. So no, you can't say, oh, you guys are fascist too. No, I'm not. You know, I'm 100% anti-fascist, no matter who they are. Right. I'm against them being in charge of my country.
Well, our guest today has been Russell Jack. I think that's, I appreciate the way you said that. That's probably a strong note to close on. Russell K. Jack, author of the book, Is MAGA a Terrorist Movement? It's available now. You can find it on Amazon, ebook, paperback. You're recording the audiobook. Is that right?
That's correct. It's actually being produced right now. And hopefully I'll have that out by end of April, beginning of May, as a guess.
Okay. So it's just a chilling topic and book and possibilities of what might happen this year. And, you know, goodbye to 30% of my previous listeners who are part of that movement. And they realize that I'm not part of it. And they've long stopped listening to this episode. But Russell, thank you for, you know, trying to bring, you know, facts and the compilation of what's happened and what it means in the book. Thank you. Thank you for taking that on. Thank you for being here with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Mark. All right,
thanks. Well, thanks again to our guest, Russell K. Jack. To learn more about him and his book, look in the show notes for links, or you can go online, markgraben.com/mistake252.
As always, I want to thank you for listening. I hope this podcast inspires you to reflect on your own mistakes, how you can learn from them or turn them into a positive. I've had listeners tell me they started being more open and honest about mistakes in their work. And they're trying to create a workplace culture where it's safe to speak up about problems, because that leads to more improvement and better business results. If you have feedback or a story to share, you can email me, myfavoritemistakepodcast@gmail.com. And again, our website is myfavoritemistakepodcast.com.